Welcome to this new nutrition business podcast. And thank you all for turning up after a very long break in our schedule. The last time we published a podcast was in September last year. And what's the reason for the long break? Well, it's because we have a business to run and we have customers to look after, and they kept us extremely busy for the past 6 or 7 months. This podcast is deliberately intended to be as controversial and provocative as possible. Yeah, possibly even more than the ones we've done in the past. And it relates to a public health initiative in Europe called Nutri-Score. And you'll probably already have seen how we feel about it, because the title of this podcast is The 10 Ways That Nutri-Score Fails. So let's just explain what this Nutri-Score thing is, first of all. Lots of countries want to improve the quality of the foods that are on the supermarket shelf. Perfectly legitimate, valid, and an important approach. Nutri-Score is a system created by a French university back in about 2016. And the idea is it creates a visual marker that goes on the front of food packages. So it's a scale of 5 colors, from dark green through to red, associated with 5 letters, from A, that's the green one, to E, that's the red one. And a dark green product with letter A is, under Nutri-Score, one that is healthier. And they become progressively less healthy until you get down to E, which is the red. And that's the warning that you really should be minimizing that in your diet. All sounds okay so far, doesn't it? The idea is that people will go into the supermarket and they'll see the Nutri-Score rating, and it will give them the opportunity to guide their choices towards a food that is healthier rather than one that is less healthy. And what's the basis for this ranking? Well, it's quite simple. It's a ranking based on whether your product has more of positive nutrients, which Nutri-Score sees as being fiber, for example, perfectly reasonable, or whether you have more of what it calls the negative nutrients, sodium, sugar, and fat, for example. The worse your score under Nutri-Score for sodium, sugar, and fat, the lower your rating. The fewer of those you have and the more of the good nutrients you have, like fiber, the more you're likely to get an A. Now, the idea behind this is that food manufacturers will be motivated to reformulate their products to include less of the bad and more of the good, and thus get more A's and B's. And it will benefit public health because consumers will choose A's and B's. It was rolled out on a non-compulsory basis in France, and also picked up in Belgium, the Netherlands, and Germany from about 1718 onwards, and is backed by the governments of those countries. However, it's opposed by governments elsewhere, such as Italy, Spain, Greece, Czech Republic, Latvia, Romania, and many others. Now, it's interesting because this system has it's consumed huge amounts of time of politicians, of civil servants, of people in companies, product developers, and senior management, figuring out how to work with it. And already many products have been reformulated, notably in breakfast cereals, for example, in a bid to obtain a higher score. And why is it being opposed? Because the system penalizes traditional foods such as olive oil. In Italy and Spain, there was huge opposition from the government, from industry, and from consumer groups, because olive oil was ranked D, a bad food. And in a minute, we'll explain why that is. And although the European Commission, which is the civil service, like the non-elected civil service body that runs the European Union, although it decided in October last year that it wouldn't be compulsory for products in Europe to carry Nutri-Score, they left the door open for a system to be rolled out. So the advocates of Nutri-Score are really keen to make Nutri-Score eventually appear on packaged foods across all of Europe on a compulsory basis. However, Nutri-Score is profoundly flawed. The evidence suggests it will be of no benefit and may even do actual harm. So what are the 10 ways that Nutri-Score fails? Well, number one, it ignores humans. It ignores how humans work. Let me give an example. Nesquik, which is a powdered drink whose number one ingredient is sugar, gets a B as being a healthier choice under the Nutri-Score system, whereas traditional Italian prosciutto gets a D. So when someone is in the supermarket and they see that prosciutto has a D and Nesquik has a B, it's perfectly logical for them to assume that Nesquik is going to be the healthier choice of the two. And why does it come out like this? Well, it seems that the algorithm weighs more heavily against prosciutto because it naturally contains some fat. Nesquik, of course, doesn't contain fat. It only contains sugar. Now, the dietitians and the academics who defend Nutri-Score say, you shouldn't, this is a ridiculous comparison that I've just made. It's not intended that people make comparisons across different categories. It's intended that you only compare foods within the same category. So you compare ham with ham, or powdered sugar-based drink with another powdered sugar-based drink. That, however, is not how human brains work. What most people see when they're in the supermarket is that something is an A, or a B, or a D, and they make the simple assumption based on simple human psychology that A means good and D means bad. There is absolutely no way the ordinary consumer, busy as they are with paying their rent, dealing with their bills, coping with their energy bills, raising kids, trying to get to work, there is no way that people are able to take on board the nuances of the fact this algorithm is only supposed to apply within individual categories and shop according to that rule. So most people looking at the label will simply go, oh, these foods are D, I will avoid them. There are others, a little bit more informed, who will do their research. They'll trawl the internet and they'll maybe discover that this algorithm is not so simple as they thought, and they'll reject it. Now, one of the points, of course, is although the advocates of Nutri-Score say that it's intended that people only compare within categories, they actually have zero evidence from the real world that people do that. And that's what you'd expect, because that's not how humans think. And what are people supposed to think when they see that an entire category has no A's or B's and all products are rated D or E, such as butter or cheese? Does that mean that all butter is bad? That all cheese is bad? Is Nutri-Score telling them that cheese is a bad food category? For some people, that's exactly how they'll interpret it. Only in the alternative universe of public health nutritionists and university academics, where it seems nobody has the faintest clue how people behave when they go in the supermarket, only in that alternative universe could they credibly come up with the argument that people will somehow understand that a D in one category is something different from a D in another category. Number two, a primitive algorithm. So you've heard me say so far that this ranking is based on an algorithm. And the argument is that Nutri-Score only compares within categories. But that argument is particularly comical. Yes, that is the word for it, because in fact, the underlying algorithm does nothing of the kind. The same algorithm is used across all categories. It is not adapted to each category. It classifies all foods in all categories according to the exact same nutritional criteria. Snacks, oily fish, cookies, ready meals, breakfast cereals, butter, beverages, all ranked against the same criteria. There's no adjustment to make an allowance for different characteristics that different sorts of foods have. The nonsensical result is that smoked salmon, ingredients salmon, salt, and mackerel get rated as a D because of the fat, the one that's naturally present in the fish, you know, the healthy fats from fish. While French fries, a processed package of French fries, can get an A if the manufacturer makes sure that there's no sodium there or a minimal fat content. And that's a real example. And then there's another aspect to it. It quickly becomes apparent when you look at this that in fact, the algorithm particularly penalizes foods that have a content of saturated fat. Now, you may think, well, that's fine. Saturated fat's bad, isn't it? And I'd have thought that 15 or 20 years ago. The dietary guidelines still do tell people to reduce their consumption of saturated fat. It's what we've all been told for 40 years. Yeah, I used to do that as well. But what we now know is that A, the original idea that saturated fat is bad for you had no scientific basis. It was invented in the 1950s by an American scientist called Ansel Keys, who left out from his studies any data that clashed with his idea that fat was bad for you. And actually, in the 21st century, there have been a lot more studies to try and better understand saturated fat. And that is why, for example, in the journal Scientific Reports, you'll find a study published in 2016, which looked at dairy consumption and saturated fat. They looked at 20,000 people, and they found, quote, no association between milk intake and cardiovascular risk. You'll also find in the British Medical Journal, which is the UK's leading medical journal, a study published in 2021 that looked at all of the available evidence on health and saturated fat and said, quote, increasing saturated fat intake was not associated with cardiovascular disease risk or mortality, and instead correlated with lower rates of diabetes, hypertension, and obesity. Do you want me to go on? A study published in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology, so this is the cardiologist's own in-house journal, in 2022, quote, there is no scientific ground to demonize saturated fatty acid. Saturated fatty acids naturally occurring in nutrient-dense foods can be safely included in the diet. In other words, the body of science says that we don't have much to worry about in terms of consuming saturated fat. However, the Nutri-Score algorithm, which penalizes products that contain any saturated fat, like the prosciutto I mentioned just now, which gets a D, that algorithm is based on a scientific report published in the UK in 2004. It was fine in 2004 with the level of understanding we had at that time to say, yeah, we should avoid saturated fat intake. As I just said, I've certainly done that myself for most of my life. But the way the science has evolved since then challenges that and forces us to rethink that. What's notable is that the people who advocate for Nutri-Score are simply ignoring the evidence that's accumulated since then. So their claim that Nutri-Score is based on science is demonstrably false. Flaw number three, Nutri-Score ignores portion size. So this is a major failing because it ignores how much you consume of a food. And it assumes everything is consumed at 100 grams or 100 mils at a time. So this utter lack of realism assumes that when someone eats butter, they consume 100 milligrams of it. Or if you put olive oil on your salad, guess what? You pour 100 milliliters of olive oil on your salad. Now, you just try doing that. And that's why olive oil, although it's we've all been told for the past 30 years it's healthy, gets a D, an unhealthy ranking. No account is taken of the quantity of food that you actually consume. And let's just imagine that you're a food company and you've been very responsible and you're offering a sensible portion size, say a snack that's just 30 grams, and plenty of those things do exist. Nutri-Score says, tough. And it evaluates your product as if the consumer is always going to eat 100 grams of it. And if on that basis you get a D or an E, that's tough. Nutri-Score doesn't care. So that means there's no incentive for companies to work on ways of offering smaller portion sizes, which, you know, might be helpful from the point of view of helping people manage overweight and obesity. So no account is taken of how food is actually consumed. Point number four. Nutri-Score contradicts dietary guidelines. You've probably already got a sense from what I said that Nutri-Score conflicts with the past 25 years of public health messaging. What is a consumer to think who has been told all their adult life they should follow a Mediterranean diet for health, and who then sees that the olive oil in their kitchen is ranked as a D? By the way, there's been a little bit of a concession by the advocates of Nutri-Score, and they now allow some olive oils under certain criteria to be ranked as a B. That's still not healthy. It's just sort of okay healthy. And if you see that mackerel and salmon, the oily fish we've been told to consume for heart health, they're labeled as D, what's the ordinary person to think? Should they continue to believe what they've been told for the past 25 years to consume more oily fish for health? Nutri-Score says not. Is it little wonder that consumers are confused, or that many of them conclude that official advice about diet is not to be trusted, and instead they turn to the internet and do their own research and make up their own mind? Nutri-Score's guidance is in direct contradiction to the dietary guidelines of many countries, such as the Netherlands, where 175 food scientists wrote to the Ministry of Health warning of the scope for consumer confusion. And in Greece, for example, Nutri-Score ranks the second most popular cheese in Greece after feta, called Graviera, as a D or an E, because, of course, it contains the naughty saturated fat. Diet soda, such as Coke Zero, however, that gets a B. So the Greek consumer is told that Coke Zero is healthier than one of their traditional cheeses, which has long been part of their traditional Mediterranean diet. And why does Coke get a better ranking? Because it does not contain calories, saturated fats, or sugars. doesn't contain any nutrients or protein either, but that doesn't seem to matter in the wacky world of NutriScore. So in simple terms, NutriScore tells people eating a Mediterranean diet that their traditional food is less healthy than diet soda. Point number five, NutriScore ignores the food matrix. So this is a little bit tricky. The food matrix, you know, references the complexity of a food. You know, if a food is a matrix composed of macronutrients like protein and carbohydrates and fat, micronutrients, the vitamins you need, various bioactive components, and they interact with each other in various different ways. So the effects of individual products can be quite different from what you'd expect if you just looked at the individual nutrients in them. So a very good example is cheese. So we've all been told most of the past 30 years to avoid or minimize our cheese consumption because it contains sodium and saturated fat. But actually, already more than 10 years ago, work which took place at the University of Copenhagen and has been replicated in other places shows that for some reason, the matrix of cheese means that the sodium and the fat don't have any harmful effects. Same goes for yogurt, same goes for milk. So the individual nutrients can't be used to predict what the outcome will be. In fact, fermented dairy foods like cheese, like yogurt, are associated scientifically now with reduced risk of heart disease. In other words, they're better for you. Oh, and also reduced risk of diabetes. So the previous view, what's called the reductionist view, where you just look at the fat content and say, it contains fat, therefore fat is bad, therefore the product is bad. The evolution of scientific understanding about the food matrix shows you can't think that way. NutriScore does, however, because it sticks to that report from 2004. So NutriScore's demonization of saturated fat naturally present in dairy, it ignores the nuances of the food matrix. It's based on out-of-date science. And then just to give you yet another example from the American Journal of Cardiology in 2020, the dietary recommendation to reduce saturated fatty acids, says the journal, without considering food sources, is not aligned with the current evidence base. And then the authors in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology go on to say, as such, it may distract from other more effective food-based recommendations and may also cause a reduction in the intake of nutrient-dense foods, such as eggs, dairy, and unprocessed meat, that may help reduce the risk of heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and other non-communicable diseases. In other words, NutriScore, as it stands, by ignoring the food matrix, once again, can be seen to be flatly against the most up-to-date, well-thought-out, and increasingly large body of science. Flaw number seven, there is almost zero real-world evidence that NutriScore makes any difference. Now, the backers of NutriScore have undertaken multiple theoretical, lab-based online studies, all in controlled environments, which claim benefits for NutriScore. But anyone who's been involved in the food industry knows very well that what consumers say in consumer research or filling in a questionnaire on a computer and what they do when they're by themselves in the actual supermarket are usually two very different things. There is no credible evidence from any real-world studies to back up the claims that NutriScore will make any positive difference. So you'd think this would be a bit of a requirement before insisting it's rolled out Europe-wide, but apparently not. There does appear to be only one study in existence on real-world effects. And guess what it found? It found that the real-world changes in the quality of consumer purchases were a tiny fraction of the changes that the lab studies said would happen. It was only 2.5% of the change that lab studies said would happen actually happen in real life. So yes, let's be fair, it was a positive, but it's a tiny positive. Now, in the real world, the Belgian supermarket chain Delhaize, they did find consumers bought more products labeled A or B, but only when Delhaize was offering price discounts of up to 15% on those particular products. Again, real world evidence continues to lean against this idea that traffic light labels and the like on packs are actually useful. For example, in 2014, Ecuador adopted a similar traffic light system, but this did not stop obesity and overweight rising from 54.8% before the system was introduced to 57.7% in 2019. Chile also introduced a really eye-catching and almost quite aggressive labeling system, much more prominent than Nutri-Score, warning people about sugar and fat and sodium and calories. If you ever get a chance to look up Chilean products online, it's really worth looking at. Sometimes as much as half of the space on the front of the package is taken up with the warning labels. However, although sales of sweetened beverages did fall, which is good, that was one of the objectives, actually it was only among higher income groups that they fell. Among kids from lower income groups, there was no difference to their purchasing habits more than half the time. And the scheme has fallen short of its own goals. One of the stated objectives of the scheme, which was rolled out in 2016, was, quote, the reduction of obesity rates in the Chilean population. And I'm sure Nutri-Score hoped to achieve the same in Europe. However, obesity and overweight among Chilean children crept up from 51.2% in 2016 to 54% in 2020. A seven-year real-world test, which made no difference to the goal that the test set itself. Flaw number eight. Europe's Nutri-Score would fail to get a health claim. And what do I mean by this? Well, companies who want to put some label on the front of their product claiming a health benefit in Europe have to go before the European Food Safety Authority. They have to present a dossier of evidence that shows that the food they are selling, proposing to sell, will really deliver a health benefit. And they have to produce a big dossier of scientific evidence to show that's the case. And the European Food Safety Authority is quite correctly scrupulous. 95% of all company requests to use a health claim are rejected owing to inadequate evidence. Now, Nutri-Score is actually a type of health claim. It's claiming that human health will be improved. But were it to go before the European Health Claim Regulator for approval in the way that a commercial claim would need to be approved, it would fail, owing to the lack of any evidence that it produces real-world improvements. Now, just because something's been created by university academics and is promoted by public health nutritionists, why should it be held to a lower standard of evidence than any other type of claim? Enough damage has already been done to human health in the West over the past 40 years by the failed dietary guidelines, by public health messages, which pushed people towards eating low fat in the 1990s and didn't make them think about all the other aspects of diet and health that will help keep the weight off. Much of the public health advice we've been given since the 1980s doesn't really stand up to scrutiny. And I've already given you the example of saturated fat. Flaw number eight, Nutri-Score only engages people who are already health active. Well, that's possible. One of the assumptions of Nutri-Score is that when people are in the supermarket, seeing the labels will make them buy A and B, so it will produce positive changes in consumer behavior. Sadly, as I intimated before, there is no real-world evidence to support this idea. In fact, what evidence there does exist says the opposite. The McKinsey Global Institute, for example, conducted a study of 16 different types of health interventions to do with food labeling. And what they concluded is they were not powerful enough to make any impact on reducing obesity. There was no evidence that they made people better off. And a study in 2020 by the Natural Marketing Institute found that people with the highest rates of obesity and overweight were less likely in the supermarket to read the nutrition information packages than people who are already of healthy weight. In fact, only 24% of people in the overweight category paid attention to nutrition labels, compared to 84% of the health active. So I said at the beginning that it doesn't take into account humans. So the assumption that people will become magically more health active has no evidence to support it. And indeed, what evidence there is tends to suggest that the opposite may be the case. Flaw number nine, it condemns whole categories. Nutri-Score both ignores, as I said before, any advances in nutrition knowledge over the past 20 years. It takes a reductionist approach to food that focuses on individual nutrients and doesn't understand that there's whole food and it's a matrix and it has its own particular way of functioning in your body. And as a consequence, it means that if a particular category, like cheese, for example, is rated D, then that's all the consumer's going to see in the supermarket. They're not going to see any cheeses rated A or B because they contain some saturated fat. They contain some sodium. Flaw number 10, it undermines the Mediterranean diet. Now, I already gave the example of olive oil, and I've given the example of the cheese in Greece, for example. Basically, we've all been told for 25 years to lean towards a Mediterranean diet because the evidence is that that improves our health. But under Nutri-Score, most traditional foods in the Mediterranean diet, whether they're French or Italian or Greek or Spanish in origin, they are penalized and mostly get ratings of D and E, if you see. So it's unsurprising that the Italian government has resisted the imposition of Nutri-Score, and Italy may actually do what Italy's done many times before in Europe and simply ignore any rules that emanate from Brussels. Now, I mentioned before that the authors of Nutri-Score have revised the algorithm very slightly. So in fairness, they've been a little bit open-minded, but not too open-minded, because it still isn't particularly different. And the revision, which was published not long before this podcast came out, to show you how unbending these rules are and how they continue to be embedded in the science of the past. Whole milk, 4% fat milk, is ranked C under Nutri-Score across the board. Coke Zero and similar sodas like that are ranked B. So Nutri-Score and your local supermarket, if they adopt Nutri-Score, will be full of messages telling people that whole milk is a less healthy choice than Coke Zero. Again, the advocates of Nutri-Score will say people aren't supposed to compare across categories, and that the mere fact they make that argument shows how desperately ignorant they are of the way that people behave in supermarkets, or how humans understand labels. Give something a simple label, and they'll just go with what they see in front of them. See bad, be better. So if you want to see how university academics can create a food ranking system that ignores dietary guidelines, that ignores portion control, that ignores the reality of how people behave in the supermarket and how they consume food, and is based on deeply flawed, out-of-date science, look no further than Europe's Nutri-Score. It may be the world's best example of how public health experts' greatest expertise appears to be in undermining their own credibility. Perhaps if Nutri-Score goes ahead, it's a signal to us that we're now at the point where the only way forward is to shut down 80% of university nutrition science departments and take all the taxpayers' money that's channeled into those. And instead of pushing initiatives which for 40 years have made no difference whatsoever, let's spend the money teaching kids in school how to cook with real food. Let's invest it in that. Let's start at the age of 7 or 8, go right up to 17 or 18. So they come out of school knowing what real food is and knowing how to prepare it in simple and nutritious ways. That would be a better use of the taxpayers' dollar or euro than 80% of university nutrition science departments. And it wouldn't make an instant difference. And actually, in this world, nothing changes instantly. But over a generation, it would. And then that generation would be able to bring up their own children with healthier habits about shopping and cooking. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Thank you very much for listening through to the end. And if you'd like to know some more about us, please go to our website, which is www.new-nutrition.com. And we'll manage to crank out another podcast sometime in the next 2-3 weeks. Thank you and goodbye. Have a good day.